You can find me.
Close your eyes. Listen to the sounds around you. Pretend that they are part of a radio feature. Every sound composed, arranged, and put in place for you, the listener.
It is notably in radio and its kindred media that poetry and sound have their most intimate kinship. There is a poetic style of making that lends itself in particular to the radio feature.
Sean Street, the sound inside the silence, travels in the sonic imagination.
This Super Science Me special, in celebration of World Radio Day 2020, is a love letter to the medium. You will hear some field recordings and some radio philosophy, and you will hear, first of all, an interview with Alistair Pinkerton. He has written a great book about the history, the technological development, as well as the societal impact of radio. His book, Radio, Making Waves in Sound, was published in 2019 at Reaktionsbooks in association with the Science Museum London.
I'm Alistair Pinkerton. I am a reader in geopolitics at Royal Holloway, which is one of the colleges of the University of London. I've recently published a new book called Radio, and it's a publication that's been produced alongside the Science Museum, which is one of the leading museums in the UK studying the history of science. And this is effectively an exploration of the history of radio as a natural phenomenon, but also as a man-made tool of communication. Now, I'm a lecturer, a reader in geopolitics. So what does a reader in geopolitics, why do we have an interest in radio? I mean, I'm trained as a geographer, and I'm really fascinated with radio because of the way it produces particular kinds of worlds of experience. So listeners to this podcast and to radio more generally will be really familiar with that phenomenon of feeling a very intimate connection with their radio and with the people and things that they hear on radios, and the way that we produce particular kinds of worlds when we listen to radio through the use of sound effects, or we conjure up particular images in our minds. But as a geographer, I'm also really interested in the way that radio has helped to shape and construct the modern world of electromagnetic communications, and has played a very pivotal role in the creation of ideas of the modern nation state. As long as I can remember, every night I fall asleep listening to the radio in bed. I listen to BBC radio, in different radio stations. Radio has just been a really important part of my kind of daily routine and daily ritual. And I think that the reason I mention falling asleep at night, because in the UK, on BBC Radio 4, at about 12:30 every night, there's a particular bit of music that gets played on the schedule, and something called the shipping forecast gets broadcast. The shipping forecast is Britain's way, or the BBC's way, of giving information about the maritime conditions in and around the United Kingdom to fishermen or other people using the sea. And it talks through different areas of the North Sea, of the North Atlantic, and actually right down to the Spanish coast, with wonderful iconic terms like Viking and Dogger and North at Sierra and South at Sierra and Trafalgar and Biscay, in reference to these different areas around the UK and the North Sea. And it's had this amazingly powerful effect on me, because as I was touring, learning about the maritime conditions in all of these areas every night, I just got this very powerful image of kind of geography, of the way that radio could conjure up a particular imagination of places and spaces.
The imagination may offer pictures of storm-beaten rocky headlands and pitching fishing boats, but for many it is a poem, the meaning of which lies within itself. As the writer Charlie Connelly has expressed it, the shipping forecast turns names and numbers into poetry. There's an innate rhythm to it. It lilts and evokes. Alec Guinness called it the best thing on the radio. Romantic, authoritative, mesmeric. Sean Street, the sound inside the silence. Travels in the Sonic Imagination, Palgrave, 2019. Since the first radio broadcasts in the early 1920s, the modern nation-state has been shaped through a close and even symbiotic relationship with technologies of mass communication. Radio had the power for the first time in human history to extend particular events, symbols, and sounds across large parts of a national population in real time and all at once. Moments of celebration, commemoration, and remembrance, sporting prowess and political intrigue, of high drama or the most everyday cultural practice, all were relayed through radio for hundreds, even thousands of kilometers from their geographically specific point of happening. Radio produced national audiences, but also determined which events in a nation's cultural repertoire might be considered appropriate for national showcasing. Alistair Pinkerton, radio, making waves and sound.
It was this political dimension of radio as means of communication that caught Alistair Pinkerton's interest in radio as a geographer and researcher in geopolitics.
I was initially really interested in radio as a tool of diplomacy. I did work in India and in the Falkland Islands as part of my PhD, and looking at the way that that Britain was negotiating new kinds of relationships with India, for example, after 1947, after India gained independence, and in particular looking at the role of the BBC World Service, which, as you probably know, is one of the world's most listened to international broadcasters. The BBC and India had a very tense relationship during much of the 20th century because, well, not least because the BBC was populated very often by ex-colonial officials, but also because Indian listeners were becoming increasingly independently minded and didn't want to hear necessarily Western voices representing India as an emerging nation. And it was fascinating to research the relationship that developed between the BBC and India during that time. I also worked in the British South Atlantic, so in the Falkland Islands, where I looked at the role of radio during the Falklands War. So it's war and diplomacy that kind of started to bridge that gap for me. So very much as a tool of communication, a tool of entertainment, but also as a means of leading to better international cooperation and communication, although, as I found in India, that sometimes failed. So that was really my professional entry point into radio.
You have been invested in this research for a long time, and also before, as you just mentioned, we're very familiar with the medium radio. But were there aspects that were particularly surprising to you or completely new to you when you during the research for the book?
Yes, the vast majority of the research for the book was completely new to me, and in most cases, utterly surprising. I mean, I had a very particular knowledge of radio. You know, it was a very geographical knowledge. It was about diplomacy and war and that kind of thing. I really knew nothing about radio as a natural phenomenon. I mean, I knew that we were surrounded by it all the time, even when we weren't necessarily aware of it. But I really didn't know about the natural origins of radio, the way that it has been effectively around as a natural phenomenon since the moment of the Big Bang. The way that we can still hear traces of the Big Bang, on our radio sets, a little bit of the white noise that we hear as we're tuning an old analog radio between radio stations. Some of that white noise that we can hear can be traced back to the moment of the creation of the universe, the background radiation that has been cooled and stretched over millions of years, and we can now hear expressed as a radio signal. The early history of radio is completely fascinating. I mean, it's dominated largely by men, by inventors, who were battling it out in order to try and develop technologies more and more quickly. I mean, one of the main figures, as your listeners will probably know, is Guglielmo Marconi, the Italian-born inventor, entrepreneur, who moved to the United Kingdom in order to further his technological ambitions for radio. So here you've got an entrepreneur. He was absolutely driven by commercial imperatives and a desire to earn money. But he was also bound up in the service of the state. So he got supported by the British government because they recognized that radio could potentially improve the safety of shipping and the maritime environment. But here you have also a complete chancer, somebody who was, he wasn't just an entrepreneur, he was incredibly opportunistic as well. And he was also interested in the theater and spectacle. So whenever he was attempting to go further than previous people in broadcasting or in transmitting radio signals, he always looked for the theatrical and always looked for the spectacular. So initially he managed to cross the River Thames with radio. And when he was doing that particular experiment, he used the services of the Speaker of the House of Commons in order to gain publicity and gain profile. Then he bridged the River Severn with radio. Then he managed to get radio signals across the English Channel. And then in perhaps the most outrageous bit of theatre, he sought in the early 20th century to broadcast or to transmit radio signals over the North Atlantic from the west coast of the British Isles to Newfoundland in Canada. And he sent, you know, he had two teams either side. He'd built vast transmitter masts. And in this bit of this particular bit of theatre, he claims to have heard the Morse code coming through his radio receiver. It's quite a well-known story, but it's deeply contested because a lot of modern scientists say it was effectively impossible, using the technology that Marconi had at his disposal at that time, to in fact cross the North Atlantic. And all of this story is bound up in subterfuge and in backstabbing and double dealings, where people like Marconi were using bits of apparatus that had been developed by other people, not acknowledging the intellectual property of those other people, but always to try and further this extraordinary race to be the first people to master the art and practice of radio.
Also, in this exploration of the wireless, there were so many inventions and discoveries in physics made that we do not necessarily connect to the medium radio right now. This was also something that I really liked about your book, and that was surprising that also inventions like radar shows up. Yeah. Something that we in the everyday life might not even connect to the medium radio that we use for entertainment and recreational purposes or for listening to the news.
No, you're absolutely right. So Sir Robert Watson Watt, a Scottish engineer and inventor, he invented radar. He noticed that if you fire a radio signal at an object, it bounces back with a slightly different frequency. And that frequency depended on the size and shape and speed of the object and the direction in which the object is traveling. And that then became, of course, part of a really important military innovation during the Second World War that arguably helped the United Kingdom and allies win the Second World War with the invention of radio. Perhaps ironically, in a brilliant story, of course, radar didn't just become a military technology. It became the bane of every driver's life because of the way that police then use radar in speed guns to catch speeding drivers. And Sir Robert Watson Watt, the inventor of radar in the 1940s, became an early victim of radar as a police bit of equipment when he was driving in Canada. And he got caught for speeding because a Canadian police officer managed to catch him with his radar gun. And Robert Watson Watt published a brilliant poem in a particular newspaper later in his life, showing how the father of radar had been foiled by his own invention and had been subject to a rather considerable fine. So perhaps he slightly regretted his early invention at that point in his life.
Yeah, that's also so fascinating that these inventions and discoveries happen so fast and were put into use so fast that you're confronted with your own invention in your own lifetime. This is also not something so common in physics, probably.
No, I think that is certainly right. I mean, clearly radio is the first, truly electromagnetic form of communication. It is the forefather of television and of all of the technologies that now dominate our lives. You know, its invention enabled Wi-Fi and the uses of mobile phones. And yet, radio was only truly invented in the late 1890s. It was then mastered as a form of broadcast by about the 1920s, let's say. I mean, it's still, by the history of kind of human invention, a comparatively modern technology. And yet we also think about radio as being quite an old technology now, purely because of the speed of change in the 20th century. And you're right, people have been confronted, like Sir Robert Watson Watt, with the full extent of their own invention, even within their own lifetimes, purely because of the way their technologies were picked up and advanced and pushed forward by a whole succession of inventors and entrepreneurs.
Radio was, for many, a new kind of space. And it was a space that was been stretched from cosmopolitan centers to cover entire nations. The editorial decisions and creativity of radio producers, administrators, and executives played and continue to play an important part in defining and refining national values and qualities for the electronic era.
And it was probably also at the time a succession of events of war and peace projects, right? That put quite a high pace to this technological development.
Absolutely. I mean, war has been a really, of course, important driver of technological innovation. You know, often, of course, devastating military apparatus, but also technologies that have then developed civilian usages. Radar, of course, is a classic example of that. There's also some wonderful examples of technologies and indeed inventors who seem to have slightly escaped widespread public acknowledgement for the work that they did. I mean, I'm thinking in particular of people like Nikola Tesla, you know, who is now quite a well-known name, and he's made even more famous by the fact that, you know, there are now Tesla cars that borrow his name. You know, a great innovator in the area of electricity and electromagnetism. Going right back to the late 19th century. He had, even in, you know, the turn of the century, the turn of the 19th into 20th century, he was such an impressive engineer and electromagnetic specialist that he'd effectively created maritime drones decades, nearly half a century in advance of other examples of this emerging as workable examples. I mean, there's a wonderful story in the book about Nikola Tesla demonstrating a submarine, a radio-controlled submarine, the most a beautifully engineered piece of equipment that used remote controls. So he was controlling the submarine from the side of this artificial pond that had been constructed in the middle of an electrical show in New York City. And he was able to, on the instructions and requests of the audience, to turn on lights on the submarine to raise and lower it in the water. And this so shocked people at the time that they did not believe that this was technically possible. They thought this was a hoax. They accused him of being a trickster. They even suspected that there might be some kind of trained primate inside the submarine making all of this possible, because people almost couldn't comprehend that technology could be advancing as fast as it had been. But Tesla was such a genius. He had literally gone beyond people's human imaginations. And in a way, that became Tesla's main challenge. He was so brilliant that the human mind at the time didn't keep up with his own personal ambition. And of course, sadly, you know, Tesla came to a rather ignominious end. You know, he died famously penniless, and having had a lot of his inventions effectively stolen by other people, because even though he was a complete genius, he perhaps wasn't necessarily always the most effective business person and entrepreneur.
Without wires and without anyone seeming to influence its movement, the boat moved across the surface of the water, turned, stopped, and reversed, and even communicated with the onlooking audience by flashing its lights in answer to their questions, all using the power of radio waves. Reports suggest that some of the onlookers thought Tesla's invention to be a work of magic. Others considered it to be an elaborate hoax, perhaps using a trained monkey contained within the boat's hull to influence its movements. Alistair Pinkerton, Radio. Making Waves and Sound. Reaktion Books. Published in association with the Science Museum, London, 2019.
A lot of the development of radio is embedded in military context, but radio as a means of communication that is potentially global, with shortwave radio that emerged pretty early in this story, it has also this utopian, peaceful aspect to it, right?
Yeah, that's right. So obviously, shortwave radio, radio waves with a very short wavelength, which have the incredible physical capabilities of traveling for at least 10,000 miles, let's say, through the Earth's atmosphere, ricocheting off the surface of the Earth and the ionosphere. You know, this was an extraordinary possibility. The idea that a single human voice could be carried across the entire surface of the Earth at clearly almost exactly the same moment was quite extraordinary. It excited people. It excited people, for example, within the structures of the British Empire. Huge global geographical political entities could be brought together in peace and harmony. Empires could be connected and coordinated in ways that had never been anticipated before. And And this really did lead to incredible utopian visions for what radio could achieve. And actually, and Tesla was interested in this kind of idea as well. He wrote about particular kinds of radio utopias and the way that radio could bring about new kinds of peaceful futures. But of course, what happened in reality was that empires embraced radio as a way of further enhancing imperial governance and attempting to hold on to parts of the empire that were becoming increasingly fractious. So it became a tool of control, perhaps before it became a tool of liberation. So people have contested what the opportunities that radio affords to people. And certainly during the early days, when radio was an expensive technology, it was very difficult to get on the air, it became a tool of government, and particularly imperial government. Slightly later on, it became perhaps more of an opportunity to resist government and to allow new emerging countries or new emerging communities to have their own say in world affairs.
On an admittedly a bit smaller scale, the radio station Orange 94.0 in Vienna, where this feature is produced, is part of this radio history of resistance and liberation. Orange emerged from the Viennese movement of radio pirates in the 1980s and 90s, contesting the monopoly of the Austrian broadcast corporation ORF to communicate with the public through electromagnetic waves. Pirate radio has a fascinating history, but it is not a thing of the past, as Alistair Pinkerton points out.
You know, across the United Kingdom, across North America and Europe, there are still pirate radio stations putting out alternative music, alternative discussion. Pirate radio is a very old phenomenon. It's almost as old as radio itself. There were wonderful examples going back to the 1920s and 1930s of pirate radio broadcasting into the UK from northern France. For example, I mean, perhaps the most famous examples of radio pirates was in British territorial waters during the 1960s, when the likes of Radio Caroline were constructed on repurposed fishing vessels and sought to try and overcome the monopoly of British radio broadcasting by transmitting new news and information and conversation, things that were not being delivered by the monopolistic BBC at the time. And that was a phenomenon that young people embraced all the way through to the late 1960s. In fact, it really only came to an end in about 1967 in Britain's case, when the UK government introduced new laws to outlaw that kind of radio piracy in ways that could have really criminalized the people who were involved. But what's interesting is that those radio stations didn't really go on and become official radio stations. What happened was the BBC was forced to change. So in 1967, as a result of this Broadcasting Act, the pirate radio stations closed down. But the BBC opens BBC Radio 1, Radio 2, and suddenly there are new opportunities for youth music on the official state broadcaster for the first time. And who does the BBC employ to broadcast those programs? They buy in the DJs who used to be the radio pirates. So they make the radio pirates official.
Pedestrian traffic lights in Arizona,
oh yeah, oh yeah.
Air hockey in Berlin, dogs in Naples, seagulls in Santa Barbara, thunder in Lyon. A sweet potato vendor in Mexico City. But most of my recordings are from Vienna and from the 22nd district, from the Danube. Ambience of Danube Island. Ice skating. The Danubian wetlands.
Also because the electromagnetic waves are so versatile and omnipresent and hard to control. This is maybe also what makes them so uncanny. This is one of the last chapters of your book, right? That you talk about the ghostly aspect of the radio. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what interested you about this? Yeah, this also very hard to grasp phenomenon of ghostliness and uncanniness of the radio.
You know, from the moment that people were started experimenting with radio, it challenged people's minds. You know, what was radio? How could you explain it? This invisible entity that could be transmitted from one place to another, and if it could be transmitted from one place to another, could it also perhaps cross other kinds of boundaries as well? Could it travel through time as well as travel through space? Could it travel between people's imaginations of different dimensions? Could it even travel between, for example, the living and the dead? And so during the early 20th century, people speculated about the possibilities of radio and its uncanny qualities, its etherealness, its ephemerality, were, you know, these became the subject of great fascination.
For many of the earliest radio pioneers, the theoretical existence of radio waves provoked profound questions about the nature of the air, the atmosphere, and the possibility that there existed an invisible medium through which radio waves traveled. A substance that connected all human beings together. Borrowing from ancient Greek and Roman natural philosophies that had sought to explain phenomena such as the motion of light and gravity, and the existence of the so-called fifth element, there emerged a suite of late 19th century theories that postulated the existence of this space-filling substance using the same classical name, the ether. Alistair Pinkerton, Radio.
People like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, for example, of course famous for writing the Sherlock Holmes novels, was a particular exponents of something called ether theory, the idea that the thing that maybe enabled radio to travel through space was the presence of a kind of ghostly ether that connected all objects together, and maybe radio was a way of kind of transmitting something through this ether. But spiritualists in the early 20th century also thought that maybe the dead continued to live around us in the ether as well, and maybe radio was a way of communicating with those spirits in that particular space, in the substance that they thought was called the ether. And so people used radio as a way, or speculated that radio was maybe a way of communicating with those who had passed away.
Newspapers reported on the invention of new radio devices that promised to link the living and the dead. And the live transmission of radio seances. The most widely publicized of these radio seances came in 1936, when Beatrice Houdini, the widow of the eponymous magician and illusionist Harry Houdini, announced a plan to raise the ghost of her dead husband by national radio broadcast on the 10th anniversary of his death. Before he died, Houdini agreed with Beatrice that if he found it possible to communicate with her in the afterlife, he would use the code words Rosabelle Believe to establish his and the medium's authenticity, although more in the hope that the failure of mediums to identify the code would aid in their unmasking. After hosting annual seances over the 9 years following her husband's death, Mrs. Houdini sought to harness the additional power of radio to extend the psychic chain and produce a final, conclusive test of the validity of claims of spiritualists. On the night of the final Houdini seance, the long-deceased magician's spirit was invoked for well over an hour. Despite the sobs and raised voices that begged Houdini to appear, no contact was made and no messages were received, leading Mrs. Houdini to very publicly announce, once and for all, that spirit communication in any form is impossible.
And I think that just contributed to this idea of radio as being an uncanny or mysterious or ghostly kind of thing. I mean, this was all helped by incredible stories that were being published in magazines during the early 20th century about bizarre radio phenomena. So during those early days of radio, in order to transmit further, people were just putting more and more power into their antenna, and that was often leading to bizarre kinds of acoustic effects. So metal objects nearby transmitters would start to vibrate and would resonate with the voices that were being carried through the air. And there are incredible stories from North America and elsewhere about tin roofs on houses that would start to act like a loudspeaker and would start speaking, or coal shovels would again start picking up bizarrely radio waves. And this was all a product of the fact that at the time people didn't really know about tuning their antenna and broadcasting on a small part of the spectrum. They were effectively broadcasting across the spectrum, and metal objects were reported to reverberate in sympathy with those signals. But it all added to this weird sense that radio was an uncanny and rather ghostly phenomenon.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, this really resonates with me, not on a spiritual level, I guess, but on an aesthetic level. I think this uncanniness, or more positively, this I think you called it intimacy in the intro of radio. This is of course also something that makes it very special as a medium and as a listening experience. Maybe you can just share a little bit more about this particularity about the medium that you find interesting as a researcher, but also as a listener, of course.
Well, I you used the word intimacy, and I completely agree with you. I think there is something extraordinary, particularly I think when using a slightly older analog radio, of that process of tuning in and listening in to something, and you've got no idea where it's coming from. And certainly as a younger person, before I now have my digital audio radio here that just selects radio stations and plucks them out of the air for me, I used to adore turning that dial and tuning in and listening to radio stations from across the Atlantic, across Europe, hearing different kinds of voices and feeling that you are the only person in the world having that particular experience, plucking a sound out of the ghostly white noise that exists between the stronger signals. I mean, for me, one of the things that really excited me about radio was another slightly bizarre phenomenon, something called radio number stations, which are effectively government-run espionage stations that used to broadcast, and in some cases still do. They just broadcast series of automated numbers, and these numbers would be listened to by spies, you know, I imagine James Bond-like characters, deep inside other countries around the world who were receiving particular signals from their government. And you can still hear, in particular extremes of the spectrum, you can still hear these signals going out today. Over recent years, some of these have actually closed down, but they were magical when you heard them. Certain radio number stations were preceded by amazing bits of bizarre music, often drawing on English folk rhythms. There was one I remember called the Lincolnshire Poacher that had that used a nursery rhyme called the Lincolnshire Poacher. There was a tune that played in, and it was just minutes and minutes of automated numbers. And when you listened to something like that, you felt that radio was somehow dangerous or subversive, and it just brings a particular kind of thrill when you're listening to it in a way that just television does not supply you with. And I think it's also maybe to do with the conditions in which we listen to radio. You know, youngsters are quite used to listening to radio quite secretly in their bedrooms at night. Certainly my generation of youngsters were quite used to that. And I think there was an element of kind of danger and excitement about listening to radio at that time.
The poetic imagination that invested radio with wonder for many of those during the development of its possibilities was probably present and inherent in the very circumstances of its transmission and in the reception of the first wireless signals of all, listened for on lonely hilltops through storms, faint signals that defied stone walls and the tiny dots and dashes of Morse code. At times, hard logic seemed to be defied by the laws of nature and by imaginative possibilities. Sean Street, The Sound Inside the Silence.
And clearly, you know, our experience as listeners of listening to the radio has changed very dramatically, even during my lifetime, you know, from the analog radio with a tuning dial, now to digital radios that just provide you with the stations in kind of digital quality. We're now able to listen to radio, of course, through the internet and on our mobile phones. But we've also got a changing understanding of radio. So, you know, Apple, the computer company, has created, you know, radio stations, but they don't broadcast, of course, over the air at all. It's purely, they use the term purely to refer to a particular mode of communication. So this is music interspersed with people talking. So the definition of radio has been stretched in a whole host of different ways. It doesn't just rely now on broadcasting through the air. And as you say, the death of radio has been long anticipated. People have been talking about radio as a dying medium really since the invention of television. People thought that TV would almost immediately replace radio. That didn't happen during the 20th century, and it doesn't show any signs of happening in the 21st century. There's lots of evidence to suggest that radio is now more popular than almost ever before. People are listening in record numbers in many countries around the world. So I think radio is a medium that's going to outlive its transmission through the air. Because radio now means so many other things. It means a particular way of listening to music and listening to particular speech that's delivered to our ears in different ways. It doesn't now rely on the electromagnetic wave. It doesn't rely on the radio wave anymore to be considered radio.
Yeah, but this origin in the electromagnetic wave is then conserved, as you also point out in the book, in our vocabulary that we say tune in. We also say that, of course, for a podcast, or even more generally, to be on the same frequency with somebody or to be in tune.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm completely fascinated by the way that radio has entered our everyday forms of speech. As you say, we tune in to things that actually require no tuning in. You know, we tune into a podcast. Sometimes we say, if we're struggling to understand somebody, you say, I've just got to kind of tune into that person's voice. We talk about radar. Something might be on our radar. Something might be off of our radar. And also just the way that we use terms like radio, and you also used the term wireless before. In one brilliant kind of little anecdote that I found, this is going back to the 1940s. This is a very British example. Of course, Britain, as you know, is obsessed with class. It's one of the things that seems to define British society. Well, there was a real concern in the 1940s and 1950s about using particular words if you wanted to be seen as upper class, or words that might give you away if you were only middle class. And radio became one of these words. So the upper classes in Britain refused to use the word radio at all. The upper classes always used the word wireless. And it became one of these little shibboleth, a little tell. If you use the word radio, you were almost certainly middle class, and you were upper class if you used the word wireless. So you know, radio was bound up in our speech, in the way that we talk, and certainly in 1940s, 1950s Britain, and arguably even through to the modern day as well, it's bound up in particular indications of class.
Apropos class. Before concluding this Super Science Me World Radio Day special with some more radio love, let's see what contemporaries of this emerging medium of mass communication had to say about it. What about, for example, the Germans Bertolt Brecht and Günther Anders? They are expectedly pessimistic about radio, but with beautiful reasons, and that's how we appreciate them. For Günther Anders, the bodiless voice coming from the radio is an intruder into the private sphere. The couple that takes a walk at the boards of the River Thames or the Danube walks their portable like they walk a dog. Or no, rather, the portable walks them. They always talk in a party of three instead of the two of them intimately. The world becomes a phantom. Die Liebenden, die mit einem sprechenden Portable am Ufer des Hudson, der Themse oder der Donau spazieren gehen, sprechen nicht zueinander, sondern hören einer dritten Person zu, der öffentlichen, zumeist anonymen Stimme des Programms, die sie einem Hündchen gleich spazieren führen. Richtiger, von der sie sich spazieren führen lassen. Ihre Promenade machen sie, da sie eben nur das Miniaturpublikum sind, das der Stimme des Programms folgt, nicht zu zweien, sondern zu dritt. Von einer intimen Sprechsituation kann also gar keine Rede sein. Ich erinnere mich daran, wie ich zum ersten Mal vom Radio hörte. Es waren ironische Zeitungsnotizen über einen förmlichen Radio-Hurricane, der an der Arbeit war, Amerika zu verwüsten. Man hatte aber trotzdem den Eindruck einer nicht nur modischen, sondern wirklich modernen Angelegenheit. Dieser Eindruck verflüchtigte sich sehr rasch, als man dann auch bei uns Radio zu hören bekam. These first lines from Bertolt Brecht's Radio Theoretical Text, Radio eine vorsintflutliche Erfindung, Radio an Antediluvian Invention, ? He remembers listening to the radio for the first time, having the impression to witness something very modern, but being very soon disappointed by the content that is carried on the ether. Man wunderte sich, was für Darbietungen da aus den Sphären kamen. Es war ein kolossaler Triumph der Technik, nunmehr ein Wiener Walzer und ein Küchenrezept endlich der ganzen Welt zugänglich zu machen. The bourgeoisie only cares about the potential, not about the outcomes of anything, writes Bertolt Brecht. The triumphal breakthrough in radio technology now allows to send the Viennese waltz and cake recipes around the globe. The potential of radio is endless. Its results disgraceful, writes Brecht. Ich wünsche sehr, dass diese Bourgeoisie zu ihrer Erfindung noch eine weitere Erfindung mache. Eine, die es ermöglicht, das durchs Radio Mitteilbare auch noch für alle Zeiten zu fixieren. Nachkommende Geschlechter hätten dann die Gelegenheit, staunend zu sehen, wie hier eine Kaste, dadurch, dass sie es ermöglichte, das, was sie zu sagen hatte, dem ganzen Erdball zu sagen, es zugleich dem Erdball ermöglichte, zu sehen, dass sie nichts zu sagen hatte. In conclusion, Brecht wishes for the bourgeoisie to make an additional invention, one that would allow to fixate all that is said on the radio, so later generations could listen to it and marvel how this class showed everyone around the globe that they have nothing to say at all. Well, this invention has been made, and by now we have big enough service to store a lot of what is said on the radio. You can listen and re-listen to this Super Science Me World Radio special at o94.at and the CBA archive of community radios in Austria, as well as on our podcast feed. Already in this small text, but more explicitly in others, Brecht also saw a utopian potential in radio, when it really becomes a mean of communication rather than a channel of distribution. Alistair Pinkerton shared a beautiful approach of becoming an active listener with me when I asked him about how writing Radio Making Waves in Sound changed his relationship to the medium and his listening practices.
Oh gosh, I have changed so much as a result of writing this book. I mean, not least because this book took me about 4 or 5 years to write, just to try and gather all this information together and to make sense of it. Because in the book, it's 45,000 words, more or less, but there are also hundreds of illustrations in there. So there's a really interesting pictorial archive of the visual culture of radio and the way that that's changed over time as well in the book. And I was very gratefully helped by the Science Museum in London, finding a lot of those images and working with them to locate that. Yeah, I mean, I now own a shortwave radio, which I love using. I very deliberately kind of challenge myself to learn more about what it is to listen to radio in different kinds of conditions. The reason I did that in particular is because I was just aware it's so easy to listen to the radio. If you're living in Europe, if you're living in the UK or North America, radio listening is made incredibly easy for us. We turn on our DAB radios and the signals are just plucked out of the air for us. But of course, in the majority of the world, radio is far more challenging. It can sometimes be incredibly dangerous to listen to the radio because you might be politically restricted about what you're allowed to listen to. But it's also more technologically challenging to listen to radio. People live in very difficult, listen to radio in very difficult conditions. And so I have a small shortwave radio that I now take with me wherever I travel around the world. And I deliberately try and access radio stations via shortwave. Because when you listen to radio via shortwave, I think you get an insight into the way that a vast majority of the world's population listen to radio, which is through kind of hastily strung up aerials and antenna listening to the radio that way. But also it forces you to be a very active listener to radio. I think most of us probably do our radio listening in quite a passive way. We might be doing the washing up or working in the garden or traveling to and from work, driving in a car when we listen to radio. But when you try and listen to that to radio on shortwave and you're listening to sounds that are being transmitted over 6 or 7,000 miles, and when it's difficult to hear and you've really got to put your ear to the receiver, you realize what it is to be an active listener, somebody who is working hard to get information out of the radio sets that they're listening to. And that for me was a very profound experience, because it changes the relationship that you have with radio, at least it did for me. because working hard for radio is I think something we should all put ourselves through at some point in our lives. It's good to be reminded about how easy we've got it, and how we kind of very passively consume information. But it's also good to be reminded about how many people have to listen to radio, and why, therefore, radio is so cherished, why it's so loved, why it's so valued in, across the continent of Africa, through much of South Asia and Southeast Asia and Latin America, where distant, remote communities listen to radio and rely upon it as a lifeline and not just as a piece of entertainment or as an accessory to our lifestyles.
Yes, that is very true. Also, it makes visible that radio, even though we call it the wireless, it's still something very material and bound to material conditions. And of course, as you just said, political conditions.
Yeah, and environmental conditions. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, I have been frequently thwarted listening to my shortwave radio, for example, when I've been in the Falkland Islands, because of the ionosphere playing up. There's too much disruption in the ionosphere, and therefore it's really difficult to listen to shortwave radio stations. So you also become aware that that radio listening is still really contingent on natural conditions. And maybe there was too much sunspot activity on one particular day, and then 2 days later, the ionosphere is being bombarded with ionizing radiation, and you just can't listen to shortwave anymore. So it thrusts you into these quite fragile and precarious networks, and you I think are just reminded again that radio is a natural phenomenon that humans have harnessed for their own communications advantage. But it's still subject to natural forces, which occasionally intervene in radio listening.
This was a Super Science Me special in celebration of World Radio Day 2020.
My name is Julia Grillmeier, and my thanks go to Alistair Pinkerton, who talked to me about his book Radio, Making Waves and Sound, and to Harald Pamminger, who read the quotations. Super Science Me.